Okay, so I'll talk about knotted lattice polygons. It's not going to be a very broad talk. I'm going to specific on some specific issues. Much of what I will talk about was, in fact, instigated by Stu in one or another way. I see him as after having proven the Frisch-Bartermann-Delbrück conjecture, Delbrück conjecture, I think Stu set off a whole set of studies on lattice law, knotted lattice polygons. Stu suggested first that we work on this, I guess, in 1990 or so. This is a couple of years after he met DeWitt. And it turns out that this field is full of open problems. There's not much we can do. Much of what we do, in fact, are computational, because we can't prove many theorems about this. So the conjecture that they settled, in fact, is one of the few theorems that we have. So just as a starting point, to give this some physical content, we look at ring polymers. And here is your typical model of a ring polymer. So this is a stick bead model. We're going to think of these as being in a good solvent all the time, so there's no solvent activity in any of the things I will talk about. There might be a monomer activity, and the models I will look at, in fact, will be somewhat unphysical in this respect, that the length of the polymer may change. But the knot type will be fixed. So this one, for example, has a knot type which is a trefoil, I think. And also, to make things even more tractable, I'm going to put them on the lattice. I'm going to look at polymers. This is a two-dimensional version of a ring polymer in the lattice, right? So in ZD. And in particular, we're going to be interested in this quantity or the consequences of this quantity, which is just the number. So we're just going to do some counting. So that Pn being the most fundamental of the quantities here, and from that we will construct things like potential functions and free energies and so on. So what can we say about Pn? So this is how you do it. I'll keep the secret away. This is one of the three tricks in this field, perhaps the simplest one. To see that Pn grows exponentially, what you do is you take two polygons. I take two polygons here, and then you glue them together. You just concatenate them. And then you just count the number of ways you can do this in. So for the first one here, you have Pn choices. When you take the second one there, you have Pm, and I have this d minus 1 taken out there, choices here. This is because you have to twist this one around in space, rotate it, until this edge and that edge lines up, right? Once they've lined up, you can remove them and put them horizontally down to get one of length n plus m. And the most number of outcomes you may have there is, in fact, that's the number of polygons with n plus m edges, right? So this gives you a basic inequality. And a consequence of this inequality is that this limit exists. And this quantity mu, we call the growth constant. Log mu is sometimes called the connective constant. Together with this upper bound on Pn, this tells you that Pn goes as mu to the n. And then there are some other corrections which you don't know much about. So this was done in 1961 already. And Chris Sotros yesterday pointed out that mu is known to many digits. So I think this is the latest record. This is Gordon Slade and Plisby. So it's known, I guess, here to four decimal places for sure, right? And then some uncertainty in the last two, in the fifth and sixth decimal place. The asymptotic behavior of this is guessed to go something like this. So here is the growth constant. There's a power law correction with an exponent alpha, which is sometimes called the entropic exponent. And then a bunch of other corrections which are lesser, right? And in 1995, I guess, Lee Madras and Socom estimated alpha and delta in the lattice, and it's about a quarter, and delta turns about about minus a half, or plus a half. So let us now just do the same for knotted polygons. So here is an attempt to make a knotted polygon. I didn't put it nice in the lattice, but it is a lattice knotted polygon. It is just rotated to give you a nice projection. And we're going to look at Pn of k, which is now just the number of lattice polygons of a specified knot type. Right? So k is maybe the L knot, or it's a trefoil, or maybe a figure eight knot or something. And as for polygons, the most basic quantity would be P n of k, and you would want to show that this limit exists. And we can't show that, but this is an open problem. There are ideas floating around about how to do this, but all those ideas, even when you limit this model by putting it into slabs or into confined spaces to give you a bit more control over the entropy, it's still not enough, because it's a basic underlying not-theoretic issue which we can't sort out. And that has to do with the unknotting number and projections you get. So until we can do that, I guess this may be an open problem. Right? I'm going to assume that this limit, in fact, exists, and there's good reason to believe that it does exist. Right? So this is not an issue which couldn't be settled, because it's not true. I believe that this limit does exist. However, proving it is a different matter. It's exactly that, yeah. Then you can do it, if I understand your question correctly. So if you say it may contain a certain density of thresholds, for example, dependent on n, then you can do it. But if the knot type there is fixed, a specific knot type is open. In any case, it's also not unreasonable to expect Pn of k to have the same kind of asymptotic growth as all polygons. In this case, we have this growth constant mu to the k, and then a power law correction to it. And there's strong numerical evidence, and I'll get you some later in the talk, that this exponent, alpha k, this entropic exponent, is in fact equal to the exponent for r naughts plus the number of components, not components you have in the knot type of k. So nk here is the number of prime components in the knot type k. So here is the Friis-Wasserman-Delbruck conjecture's resolution, I guess. It's this theorem. It says that the unknotted polygons have a smaller growth constant than polygons. Right? So they're naturally rare compared to it. I've put mu k in here in the middle. It's known that the growth constant for knotted polygons is at least as big as that for unknots, but it's strictly smaller than that of all polygons. And this is a result by Christotros, Guest, and Witten, too. Numerically, this has been measured. The distance between mu and mu one naught is of order 10 to the minus 6. Right? So it's a small number. If you look at what we know about mu, mu, it's about 4.6838, and mu one naught must have the same first four digits. And then after that, it'll probably be different, right? So this digit and that digit may be different. It has to be checked. And I think it's possible. I think you can do it. It's easier to get this than to get that, right? Much easier. So you'll have to get this by another way. Enumeration would be very hard to do this, because you have to check the knot each time you make a new polygon. So let me now put this in confined spaces, because I'm going to put these knotted polygons in confined spaces and then look at their properties. So here, I've taken that polymer I have, or the polygon I have, and put it in a slab, which I will call LW, and W will be width of the slab. Right? And again, we're going to ask questions about what's equilibrium length given a certain activity. Here is a lattice polygon in the slab. So again, you take the lattice, the cubic lattice, for example, in this case, because we'll talk about knots, and we put the polygon as a lattice polygon in the slab, and the width is W. And so there are a number of questions you may be asking, things about the growth constant and the free energy, etc. And I'll get to those in a minute. Now, let me just tell you a little bit more about polygons in the slab. So if I take a polygon, so this is just a schematic of it, and a slab of width W, I'm going to define Pn of W. Now, W should not be confused with K, which is the knot type. So this is any polygon, and a slab of width W, they are expected to grow also at the same kind of exponential rate than polygons in bulk. So there's some growth constant, and there's a power law correction with an entropic exponent. And this limit is known to exist. And this is a result of Christens too, some years ago. How you show that limit exists is just an extension of the concatenation, the construction I gave you earlier. You can again take two polygons. Here I take Pn and another polygon which has length m in a slab of width w, and then you put another skinny polygon just between them to separate them. And then by moving these two together, you can glue these three together into a single polygon which is longer. So that's how you do the concatenation. This is easy in two dimensions, but in higher dimensions this becomes quite tricky. However, you get an inequality of this type, and this is enough to show that in fact you have a growth constant mu w in this case. In three and more dimensions, walks and polygons turn out to have the same growth constant. Okay, the scaling and the free energy of these objects. So here again I have my polygon and a slab. The slab is with W, and the polygon will have some characteristic size R. Right? So there are two length scales in this problem. And what you would do is this is a very standard argument. You say that the free energy would be an intensive quantity, which is a function of R divided by W, the ratio of the two length scales. If you now, multiply this by W to the 1 over nu, you can write it in that form. And that gives you the explicit dependence of the free energy on the width of the slab. Since you know that the free energy is the log of the growth constant, you get this behavior of the growth constant with W. So the growth constant mu W goes mu, where mu would be some bulk quantity, the growth constant in bulk, times the exponential, which depends on W. And this you can just expand into this form. So this is useful because it tells you how the generating function of these things will, what the critical shape of the generating function will look like. So we know this. So this we know. That's a theorem that if you take mu w to infinity, that mu w approaches mu. That you can prove. This is what that scaling argument on the previous page gives you. And so you can look at the generating function of polygons in a slab with an activity t, or a generating variable if you want to use that term instead. And so the singular part of this generating function must have that form. Right? You get it out of here. It must be the log of mu wt to the exponent 2 minus alpha w, where alpha is the entropic exponent. Of course, for polygons, g is finite even at this critical point, and so g of w must be, equal to the generating function in three dimensions, and this is how it approaches it at that rate. So what this would allow you to do, for example, is if you look at your lattice polygons and slabs of width w, and you for example, pick your activity to be 1 over the critical value of the 1 over the growth constant, then the average length of these polygons must just be the derivative of log g. And if you put into g what I had before, Kirk behavior, you get this kind of expression. And since we know what mu w over mu is, it is 1 minus c w to the minus 1 over nu, you can evaluate this at least up to leading order. And so it goes as a constant, and this is the first correction to it, w minus 1. It's an exponent here which depends on mu, which is the metric exponent, and alpha w, which is the entropic exponent. And so this gives you, to leading order at least, the dependence of the length of the polygon in this generating function as it is confined in the slab, dependent on W. For knotted polygons, we're going to assume that the entropic exponent will be removed from the exponent for our knots plus the number of components in the knot. Right? So this is, again, consistent with what I had before for polygons in bulk. So now you can go and see what this means numerically. So you're going to pick values for alpha. This is alpha R naught, and for nu, which are known or have been estimated, and then you substitute it into this expression I had for the average length, and what you get is the following behavior. If you put an unknotted polygon in a slab, and you estimate its length, you'll see that as a function of W, as W increases, it should approach a constant C1. Right? So it doesn't increase, it just goes up to some limiting value as you make the slab thicker and thicker. If you Instead, to the trefoil in that slab, so a non-trivial knot in this case, then it will keep on growing with W. So as you increase W to infinity, the trefoil will keep on getting longer and longer. This is quite different from that of an unknot, for example. So there's a basic statistical difference between unknotted polygons and polygons of any knot type. So for prime knots, you get this power here to be 0.85. Now, I wouldn't bet my house on that, right? These are all estimates based on a very general scaling argument. But for prime knots, the interesting thing is, independent of the knot type, you will always get W to the 0.85. If you compound the knots, and this is any number of components in the knot, it doesn't matter, you're always going to get about 1.7. Right? So it's going to grow at a different rate. Just to point this out to you, if you plot the average length of polygons in this ensemble, and they are unknot, then they will have a concave curve, increase as a concave curve to a constant, right? If you take a prime knot, it's going to increase as a concave curve without bounds. And if you pick a compound knot, it is going to increase convex. So there are three different shapes here. And so can we test this? And to test this, you need an algorithm to make knotted polygons. And it has to be an algorithm that works. So here is one that makes knotted polygons, and it's the only one we have which do make knotted polygons in the right way. It's called the BFACF algorithm. It's very old. It comes from the 1970s, I believe. We can make knotted polygons, for example, doing pivots, but the problem there is that you don't maintain the knot type. Right? So every time you do a pivot move, you change the knot type, and you have to check. You have to compute knot invariance to find out what knot type your polygon is. In this algorithm, you can start with a polygon of a specified knot type, for example, trefoils, and it will sample them and keep them as trefoils. It will only sample trefoils, for example. So what you do is you take a polygon and you make small changes to it to sample along a Markov sequence in the state space of polygons. What you do is you implement two kinds of moves on your polygons. You look at sequence of edges. You may, for example, do this kind of move where you move this vertex over across to that corner there. And, of course, it will be in balance. You'll be able to move back as well. This move conserves length, right? It doesn't change the length of the polygon. There's a second move you do, or a second elementary move, and that is operates on structures like this in your polygon, where you take an edge and you move it down and delete these two vertical edges, and that gives you just a straight line of three edges there. And, of course, the reverse of that. So you take your polygons and you operate with these moves on it, and that is the basic idea underlying this sort of Markov chain sampling of knotted polygons. There's a transition probability matrix associated with these moves. If you look at two polygons, suppose you have a polygon omega, and you change it into omega prime by one of these moves, if omega prime happens to be the same length or shorter, you accept that move with probability 1. Right? If it turns out to be longer, well, then you accept it with a reduced probability. Right? So you form this fraction here on the length, and then you introduce a parameter t, which would be conjugate to the length of the polygon. So the basic implementation is just as follows. You choose an edge, and then you move this edge in one of two d minus one ways perpendicular to itself, right? And that will tell you, if you look at the geometry, local geometry, that will tell you if this is a move of type 1 or type 2. And then you just accept or reject this move with this probability. You just implement that. So this is a Metropolis-style implementation, and it's slightly different from an optimal implementation which was originally given for this algorithm, but it's good enough. And so here's a stationary distribution of the algorithm. This is the indicator function on L, and it is 1 if omega is of knot type L and 0 otherwise, right? So there are two parameters here. The parameter Q, which you choose beforehand, it may be 1 or minus 1 or something, doesn't matter. And then this parameter T, which is conjugate to the length. And the heuristic classes of this algorithm is well understood. So there's, in fact, a theorem which says that if you apply this to unrooted polygons in the cubic lattice, then the aggressive classes are the knot types. Right? So it will sample from, for example, all trefoils in the right way, and this will be the station distribution on that aggressive class. And so he implemented by just picking an initial polygon. So entropic exponents of knots, I've mentioned this very briefly before just to make my case a little bit stronger. We have thought that the number of lattice knots, Pn of k, goes as a growth constant to the n and then a power law correction which involves this entropic exponent alpha k. You can use this VFACF algorithm I just explained to you to measure these quantities ak, alpha k, and mu k. And so here are some results which are 10 years old. For example, we measured, I guess it was 1996 or 7, the unknotted, the growth constant of the unknot for the trefoil and then for the compound trefoil. I have more examples. But to the first two digits, they all agree. And this is what you would expect. Right? So this algorithm is, in fact, good enough to show you this. You can look at the entropic exponent by computing this quantity rho, which is just a ratio of alpha k plus 1 with itself. If two knots have the same entropic exponent, of course, you'd expect that rho is 1, right? If it's about 1.75 when you compare a knot to the unknot, then its entropic exponent is 1 bigger. And if it's 1.44 compared to 3.1, then it's 1 bigger than that of 3.1. So you can test this numerically. And if you do that, the BFACF algorithm gives you the following estimates. So it tells you, for example, that if you compare 3.1 to the unknot, you get 1.69, and you can take a figure 8 knot or the knot 6.2, and the all around 1.7, which is close to that quantity I gave you. So this is consistent with telling you that the entropic exponent of any one of these three knots, the all prime knots, is in fact just one different from that of the unknot. Here's other examples that we looked at. So you can compare 3.1 and 4.1. You should get 1, and you get about 1, which means they have about the same entropic exponent. As you can look at compound knots, you can take the granny or the square knot and compare it to the trefoil, and you get about 1.25, and this is a fairly big error bar, so this is still consistent with our belief that alpha k is alpha naught plus nk, where nk is such a number of components. More interestingly is that this amplitude ak, I didn't talk about that, also turns out to be independent of knot type. All the corrections in this assumed form for the number of polygons of the best knot type goes into, well, lower order terms. So in a slab, you would want to apply this algorithm, but of course now you have to go and check again that you can do it. In fact, you have to show that its aggressive classes are in fact that of the knot types, even if you put a lattice polygon like this one in a narrow slab. And so I can prove what I have. This is already done. You can prove that if you put your lattice polygon in a slab, then you can in fact prove this theorem. So the if you implement the BFACF algorithm on polygons in a slab, then you can transform one lattice knot into any other lattice knot, a lattice knot. By just doing elementary moves on this. And the theorem goes roughly as follows. If you take a lattice knot like this one and you look down the z direction, it has a knot projection. Right? This projection is not what knot theorists call regular, because there are some vertical edges in it which projects the points. But I'm going to ignore those, and I'm just going to indicate overpasses and underpasses and orient the knot in some way like this. And you have to understand that either this corner there or that corner there has a vertical edge to bring it over. Right? I will call such a projection regular if all the double points in it are in fact crossovers. Right? It hasn't any other singular points in it which are not of this type. And how you prove that this algorithm has in fact aggressive classes or not is you take your lattice knot Now, arbitrary lattice knots in this case in a slab, and to show that by applying these two elementary changes to it, you can turn it into a polygon which has such a regular lattice knot projection. The second step is you have to show you can do Rademacher moves. Now, Rademacher moves are moves which connect knot diagrams, and the second theorem you prove is that if you apply these elementary moves from a BFACF algorithm, you can do Rademacher moves on these regular lattice knot projections, and you can do them such that you make two knot diagrams equivalent in the lattice. So for example, here is how you would do Rademacher 3. So here you have three crossings in a knot which have in the slab only thickness 1, and then you simply move this part up and then eventually over and put it down on the other side. And that's a typical Rademacher 3 move. And you have to check the others as well. Of provided that W is bigger than 1, you can do this move. But you can't do it in a slab of width only 1.
What can you do in a slab
with 1? Well, the pivot algorithm can be done, but it's not suitable for this kind of calculation. So the next steps are in fact, it's just that once you have knot diagrams in the lattice, which are now equivalent to one another, you have to show that you can make them identical by doing these BFACF moves. And you have to do it sort of region by region. So it's somewhat tedious, but you can do that. And then finally, you have an algorithm which you understand and you can apply to this kind of problem. So I have sample polygons of specified knot types now in slabs up to width, I guess, 22. After that, the statistics becomes a bit hard to keep track of. It becomes hard. So the expectations for the average length, of course, again, is constant if it's the R-naught, and divergence concave is cave prime, and so on. And so here is the one for unknotted polygons. So I sampled these in slabs. So in this graph, the width of the slab is this horizontal axis, and it goes up to 22, and this is the average length. And you can see these clearly approach a constant. So, you know, you measure the average length, and they increase nicely, and it's a concave curve, as you would expect. And it levels out, you know, if you do a least squares fit here, to about 7.2 or so. The solid line here is drawn on the points where if you do this, if you assume this fit to n, you get a good fit. Right? You get the statistically acceptable fit. Here I do trefoils. Now, on the previous page, the vertical axis only went up to about 10. Right? When you do trefoils in these slabs at the same temperature, you have a much stretched y-axis. It now goes up to 200 or so. And I have plotted the average length in this way and fitted through it the curve, which has this form. There's another term here, w to the minus 1, just to keep track of these small deviations here at very small w. I wouldn't bet my house that this curve is concave, right? It's supposed to be. It certainly fits well to W to the 0.85, but you know, this is the problem statistics. I think you'll have to go up to much bigger W before you really will see that it is concave. So if you go up to W of 50 or so, perhaps it will start to turn over a bit better. If you sort of eyeball it from one side, then you know, you could believe it's concave. If you do compounded trefoils, again, the previous graph had scaled up to 200. This one now goes up to 600. This line here is the curve of trefoils I gave you. And so here I've done, this is a granny knot, isn't it? Square knots. This is a square knot, and here I've done knots with three components of trefoils. And you can see clearly they increase convex in this case, and that's what you would expect, right? This curve here is the one we had on the previous slide. But for the compounded knots, for these two, I have assumed W to the 1.7, and you clearly see that. So here are other prime knots, just to round out the picture a bit. I've taken notes up to six crossings, I guess, here, and computed the average length as a function of w. And again, these should all be having this functional form w 2.5. Now, the fact that here at low w, it doesn't quite conform to this, of course, is due to the fact that the slab is very narrow compared to vertical edges, right? So I think this is just strong interaction between the knot and the slab, but as the slab increases, eventually they all straighten out, and if you go W very high, in fact, it will turn over concave, or I believe it would. I have a little bit of time, do I? 9 minutes. I'll talk very briefly about the metric properties of these knots. So you can compute the mean square radius of correction, R squared, in this ensemble for knotted polygons in this way, as a function of W, so the width of the slab. And so they do what you expect they to do, right? So we know already that the mean length for unknotted polygons stays small, and so the mean square radius of correction was still small, right? And for more complicated knots, well, it increases because n increases. So this is not too surprising. What is more interesting, in fact, is when you compute an amplitude ratio. And so I'm going to look at S of xy, and this will just be the mean span in the xy plane. So you take the smallest box in the xy plane, which will contain the projection of the polygon, and you take the average side length of that, and you take a mean of that over your sample. So here you get the span SXY of that, and now I'm going to form a dimensionless quantity by taking the square of this thing and divided by the mean square radius of correction. Right, so this compares the horizontal spread, if you wish, of the polygon to that of its overall size. And so AFK is dimensionless. So for small w, you would expect this to spread out in the xy plane because the slab confines the knot. And for large w, of course, when you take w up to infinity, you take off the constraints of the knot, the theory constraint, and so this should approach some constant, right? As w goes to infinity, it's dimensionless, right? So it should approach a constant. And so for small w, you'd expect this to be bigger, and then perhaps it should decline to some constant value as w increase. So here are some ratios for trefoils and compounded trefoils. I have the R naught here, and the R naught just stays constant except when you are in a slab of zero thickness, right? So it sits up here at 7 or 8 or so, and then immediately when w is 1, it just stays flat, right? If you look at trefoils, however, it starts around 20 or so, and then it decreases, and then it goes through a constant regime, where increasing W doesn't change that amplitude ratio very much. What this means, of course, is that the knot grows proportional to W in some way in all directions. Right? It doesn't grow horizontally more than it grows vertically. Eventually, there seems to be a slight downturn when you get up to large W, but this is not so easy to see here. And then for compounded trefoils and trefoils with three components, it's the same, right? So it stays constant. Eventually, it might start to turn down. If you look at more complicated knots, that turn down eventually is maybe a bit pronounced. Here, I have stretched the axis, right? So it's not from 0 up to 25 anymore. It's now from 16 to 25. So it's the same graph as the previous, but I've stretched the axis. And here I've looked at prime knots now, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5 crossing knots and 6 crossing knots, and plotted these amplitude ratios. So initially, a downturn, so a decline in this amplitude ratio, then a constant regime, and then eventually it should decrease, right? And then approach a constant as the W goes to infinity. And the same goes for the other knots. So there are three phases, if you wish. These are not quite phases in sigma x's end, but the three regimes. For small w, you see a declining amplitude ratio. And so what this indicates is that there's a very strong interaction between the slab and the knot, that the knot is theoretically pressing the slab is pressing the knot theoretically such that it is deformed horizontally, it spreads out horizontally, and that as you increase W, at these small values, it decreases very quickly. This intermediate W, where this amplitude ratio is more or less constant. It's still a strong interaction between the knot and the slab, because the knot is aware of the slab, right? As the slab stretches, it goes in all directions at the same rate. And so this stays constant, but the knot knows there is a slab, right? And then for large W, you start to see AFK declining, and the interaction becomes perhaps a bit weaker. Of course, when W goes to infinity, it should go away, because the knot, there are very good arguments for this, the knot is in fact confined to a small region of space in the scaling limit. The statistics of a knotted polygon of a single knot type, a prime knot type, is in fact that of a polygon with a root on it. Right? That is what it is. That's why the entropic exponent only differs by one. And so this is why this should decline to a constant. You can compute averages of this. This gives you some sort of measure, I guess, about the how strongly the knot interacts with the slab. And so here are a couple of conclusions. So as I said, most of this is numerical, and it's numerical because there's a little we can do rigorously, right? As I said, proving theorems in this field is almost impossible. The easy ones have been done, and I said this with respect to Stu and DeWitt, right? So anything that's easy has been done, I think. And all the other problems are easy to state. Right? It's easy to tell you that I think the following is true. And you may even go and, like many of us have, including me, go and sit at your desk for a couple of days and see if you can wrestle through a theorem. Because you have this very great idea which will make it work. And of course, it never works, because there is always some aspect of it, either not theoretic or just plain constructive, which makes it very hard to do. However, in the context of this talk here, you know, I've given you physics arguments, essentially, right? The scaling arguments about the mean length of knotted polygons at a certain activity, which I picked to be 1 over the growth constant of our knots. And I've shown that you can use this algorithm, this very old algorithm, to sample polygons of a specific knot type, which is a nice thing to be able to do if you are interested in knot statistics, right? The model I have here is somewhat unphysical, but sorry, that's the best I can do at this point. And then we have these results on knots in a slab that the unknot doesn't like or doesn't see confined spaces as well as a knotted polygon does. So when you put a knotted polygon in a confined space, it knows it, right? The unknot is not quite aware of it. So there's a real difference between these two. And then if you have prime knots and compound knots know more than prime knots that they're confined, right? That's what the scaling argument tells you. It doesn't matter what the compounding is, as long as it's compound. Number of components, 2 is as good as 10 in that case. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes, it is. So it's and this is not a good term for it, but we call it the grand canonical algorithm. Right, so you change the length of your polygon, and so, I mean, ideally, right, if you want to model polymers which are knotted, you need a fixed length algorithm. Now, we can do that at huge computational cost, doing pivots, for example.